Thanks very much, Michael. Stan and Rudy would be honoured to hear themselves feted like that in Brisbane today. So thanks very much for inviting me here today, and particularly to, for Julian for getting me along here. It's great to be in Brisbane. So as an economist, you're into forecasting. So the fact that it's beautiful today, I'm guessing that it's going to be perfect the next. Anyway, today, the economists are not known for their sense of humour. Today I'm going to talk about something which central banks do talk about a little bit, which is inflation. And in fact, all of the talk today is going to be on inflation. So let me start off by showing where inflation is. So here's nearly 30 years of inflation in Australia, and shows you the period since the inflation target came in around 93.4. And at the moment, as you can see right at the end there, the inflation rate is currently just over 2%. So as of today, that's actually consistent with the inflation target for the Reserve Bank that's agreed between the Governor and the Treasurer. But as you can also see in that graph, that follows a period where inflation's been a bit below target for a number of quarters. So you actually calculate the average inflation rate over this period, it's actually smack on 2.5%. It's averaged 2.5% since the inflation target was introduced. But over the past 3 years, it's actually averaged 1.8%. So how broad-based has the recent decline in inflation been? So in 2016, only around one quarter of the CPI basket, so if you split the CPI, and I'll show you what the basket looks like in a sec, but if you split the CPI basket up into its different components, only around one quarter of them had an inflation rate of above 2.5% in 2016. And in the June quarter, so the most recent number, this had risen only to 40%. To look at it another way, and I'll actually show you this one. So this is this is showing you the share of the basket which has been below its inflation targeting average. So if I take the CPI basket, calculate the average inflation rate over the past 25 years or so, and then show you how much of that has been below average. So for each price component, 80% of them have been below average for the last over the past 3 years. In the most recent quarter, have been below their average over the past 25 years. So there have been clearly a number of macro factors at work that have contributed to these outcomes. But today I'm going to focus on some of the individual price developments that underpin the aggregate inflation outcomes. So I'm going to go down into the weeds of the CPI and examine the pricing dynamics at a more disaggregated level and show and discuss how these dynamics have changed in recent years. So this gives you a rough overview of where I'm going to go. I'm going to go through most of these categories of the CPI in a bit more detail, talk a bit about retail, technology, some of the housing-related components of the CPI, what we call market services, and then some administrative prices. And then I'm going to talk about utilities, which is a topic which is obviously getting a fair amount of publicity at the moment, or was yesterday at least. If I've got a bit of time, I'll talk about tobacco at the end. So an understanding of what's going on in these changing dynamics across these different components gives you an idea which is potentially useful in assessing the outlook for inflation as well. So some of the important drivers of the recent low outcomes include competition in the retail sector, historically low increases in rents, so the cost of renting a house, low wages growth, which we've obviously talked about at length for quite some time now, but also some slower growth in some of those administered prices, ones which tend to be set by governments generally. So let me start talking about retail. So what I've got here is a graph of retail prices. I've switched from growth rates to levels now. So this shows you the level of various components of the retail basket in the CPI. So food outside fruit and vegetables, because fruit and vegetable prices tend to jump around a bit, and then consumer durables. So what you can see here is that for the last decade or so, the price of the typical food basket hasn't actually moved much at all. So basically, you're paying the same today as you did about a decade ago for your average food basket. This would be, so really, for once, the advertising is actually about right. They really are everyday low prices. That's the way they've been for the last decade or so. Also shows you that the price of consumer durable items such as fridges and furniture, adjusted for improvements in the quality of those goods, and I'll come back to that in a minute, have not changed noticeably over the last 25 years. So two fairly large components of the CPI basket, food and consumer durables, not much has happened in those prices for quite some time. Even more notably, the prices of audiovisual equipment have declined by 90% over the past 25 years, and I'll come back to that later. So clearly in the case of consumer durables and audiovisual equipment, technological improvements have been an important factor. But competition in the retail sector has also played a significant role, and particularly recently. So one way of illustrating the effect of competition on retail prices is by examining the changing dynamics of the way that changes in the exchange rate affect price changes for retail items. So when the exchange rate depreciates, say, we can measure it both when it comes across the dock and we can also measure it when it's sold in the store. So the movement, the relationship between the exchange rate changes and the price across the docks is pretty much one for one, and that hasn't changed in 25 years. So when the exchange rate goes down, the price over the dock goes up, pretty much one for one, and that's still the case. So that part hasn't changed. What has changed is what happens next. So when it leaves the docks and ends up on the shelf in the store, the relationship between movements in import prices at the docks and retail prices has broken down over recent years, and there's been a shift in those pricing dynamics for retail goods. So if we go back a few years ago when we had the depreciation of the exchange rate, about 20-odd percent, price of import prices over the docks went up by roughly the same amount, but it didn't translate through until the price on the shelf in the store. And a fair bit of that probably, almost certainly, has to do with competition in the retail sector. So some part of it may also have been slower growth in consumer spending over this time frame, particularly compared to earlier periods like in the 90s and through to the mid-2000s. But a fair part of it is almost certainly got to be competition. So one aspect of that, obviously, is that the internet and technology more generally have meant that foreign retailers can now compete with local retailers for online shopping. So that's a small, but actually, so it's rapidly growing, but it's actually still a fairly small share of the market. So according to the ABS, in June, online sales made up around 5% of total retail sales, maybe a bit higher than that. It's grown by 50% over the past year, but it's still only 5%. So it's not all a story of online shopping. But obviously, the competitive pressure is not confined to online market share, with a large number of large foreign retailers also setting up bricks and mortar retail operations in Australia. In addition to this direct competition from this source, there's also greater information about prices. So technology is providing consumers with much greater information about prices, allowing them to comparison shop more easily and negotiate greater discounts of listed prices. So competition is not easily observable, but we can look at some proxies for it to assess how it has changed. And so a couple of the ones we've looked at use a database that the ABS has got out there now. So if you're in the research business, I recommend you having a look at this. We've now got a business longitudinal data, so tracking businesses through time, and it's quite a rich source of data. And one of the things we've looked at is markups that you can measure out of that, or margins. So markups basically is the ratio of a firm's sale price to its marginal cost, so the cost of providing one more unit of the good. And we can look at the ratio of prices to the average cost of production and just see how that's changed through time. So if you look at that business longitudinal database, we see that those margins peaked in around about 2011, 2012, and I've got a graph on this in the printed version of this speech. And they've generally declined since then. Now, those data are only available up to 2014, 2015. We're about to get the next cut of data imminently. More timely data on retail net margins show a similar story. So when we got trawled through all the reports from the various retailers, we can see the same thing. Net margins for food and other retailers have declined over the past few years. So there clearly has been downward pressure on margins, almost certainly due to the increased competition in the retail sector. Companies have responded to the increased competition by reducing their costs and improving their productivity, And that's obviously been evident in the retailers themselves, but it's also been evident in the supply chains. And that's put further downward pressure on prices. So labour productivity growth in the retail sector has averaged 3.5% since 2010. So that's really high compared to almost every other part of the economy. So how that retail competition and the effect of that on inflation plays out over the period ahead is one of the uncertainties for our forecast. So there have obviously already been foreign entrants into many parts of the retail sector in recent years. So Audi has been here, I'm not sure it's been here in Brisbane for a long time, it's been in Australia for quite a long time now. And so their effect has probably mostly worked its way through, and that's already driven down margins in the sector. But there are other entrants who are only just establishing their foothold, one very obvious one, which suggests that they at least regard the current level of margins as still quite attractive. So if you go back to 2007, margins in retail in Australia were clearly pretty attractive for everyone. So a bunch of people came in. But the fact that people are still coming in suggests they're still fairly attractive to at least a number of foreign players. So our expectation is that these competitive forces in retail probably haven't run their course, but may still have some way to run. That said, there's some prospect that the effect of margin compression on the rate of food price inflation, which I've got here, could be nearing an end. Recent commentary by market analysts suggests that the transition by some supermarkets to everyday low price strategies may have run its course. In part, as I said, those competitive pressures in the supermarket space have been there for more than a decade now. The other thing, though, which is going to obviously affect food prices in the coming quarters is the severe drought in some parts of the country, including around here. And based on what happened in previous droughts, the initial effect actually is that you'll see meat prices probably go down, and we're seeing that now actually, as slaughter rates increase, but then to rise beyond that. The impact on food and veg prices actually is a bit less clear looking at previous droughts, but more likely than not, the effect is going to be to put food prices up rather than down. One thing that's worth noting is that the ABS now uses scanner data and is better able to capture what's called low-level substitution price. So if the price of one piece of food goes up, you can switch to something else. In the past, the ABS wouldn't necessarily pick that up, but now they can, or do it a lot better because of the fact that they're using the scanner data from the supermarkets. So that might mitigate the impact of the drought on measured inflation. Beyond the effect of technology in contributing to greater price transparency and allow households to comparison shop, it's obviously had a direct effect on the price of a number of retail goods. As I said, most obviously, audio, visual and communication goods such as TVs and computers, and also phones, which is the top line here. So this shows you, as what I said earlier, the price of audio, visual and computing equipment is it's fallen by about 90% over the past 25 years. The price of phones or telco equipment and services, which includes things like phone plans as well as your phones. In fact, nowadays it's mostly your phone plan rather than your phone. That have been actually flat for a while and has taken a big leg down over the last 4 or 5 years. Now, one thing you've got to bear in mind when you look at that at this is that when the ABS measures inflation in these sort of things, it adjusts for the changes in the quality of the good or service where possible. And so advances in technology generally improve the quality of products across a number of different dimensions, and the ABS aim to capture this in their measure of inflation. So smartphones are a good example. So changes to processing speed, data storage, and camera quality are accounted for in these measures, and they've all contributed to the measured declines in the prices of computers and phones. So while you might go into the store and pay exactly the same price as you paid 3 or 4 years ago, as everyone is probably pretty familiar with, you're generally getting a better product. One thing to bear in mind is that the ABS adjusts for all the different features that are available to you, even if you don't want them. So you might not value some of the services that your phone or computer is giving you, or you might have no idea how to actually use them, but the ABS will still regard that as a quality improvement, and that will be reflected in the price. So from the household's perspective, they may go in and saying, well, hang on a sec, I'm still paying the same as I did for a telly 20, 25 years ago. And the answer is in that case, it probably has gone down some, but you're getting a hell of a lot better television set than you used to. And whether people attribute those quality, think about those quality changes is not quite so clear. So even though the measured component of the way these prices are measured in the CPI remains relatively constant, as I said, the important thing to note is the quality may well be changing. So as you can see here, the price of mobile phones and handsets and plans, so the orange line at the top, has also fallen. Now, one of the reasons why it started to decline in around 2014, 2015 is the ABS actually changed its methodology in terms of the way they measure things like mobile phone plans. We put out something on this a while ago. But anyway, the fact that that orange line has gone from being flat to declining by around about 20% over those last few years, or 5% per annum, that all by itself has taken off nearly a quarter of a percentage point off the annual inflation rate for the last 5 years. So mobile phone plans have taken by themselves around about a quarter of a percentage point off the aggregate inflation rate. So clearly one thing which is relevant here is that price measurement when there's technological change is a long-standing challenge for statisticians, not obviously going away anytime soon. So there's a challenge of how you appropriately capture those changes in quality. And there's also the challenge of ensuring that the weights that the ABS uses to aggregate the price of the various goods and services appropriately reflects households' expenditure patterns. As prices change, people change what they spend on. So it may take some time for new goods and services in particular to be included in the CPI basket. And more generally, there's the issue of ensuring that the CPI appropriately takes account of changing expenditure patterns in response to those movements in prices. So as of very recently, the ABS has just begun updating its CPI weights on a much more regular basis. They're now going to update them annually. So in the past, it could be 4 or 5 years before they updated that, and that introduced a decent substitution bias into the calculation of the inflation rate. That's pretty much disappeared going forward. Let me now turn to housing. So one thing, and I'm not going to talk about this today, so house prices, not in the CPI. That's pretty much a speech all for itself. But what is in the CPI? These two things, and they actually have a pretty large weight. So if I go on that slide I showed earlier, if you look at how these two components, they're 8 percentage points and 7% of the total CPI each. So rent is just the straight cost of renting a house or a dwelling, and then new dwelling costs reflects the cost of building a new house or apartment, and they've only recently started including apartments in that as well. It used to only be, basically used to be a kit home, roughly. Now it's both apartments and houses. So you can see there that that notwithstanding the fact that we've had on the bottom panel, historically high levels of activity in housing construction over the last few years, including in Brisbane, new dwelling cost inflation has actually been running a bit below its long-run average. So what seems to have been going on is that during the late 2000s, new dwelling cost inflation was higher than it is currently because the residential construction sector was competing for materials and labour with the resources sector, which is obviously in the midst of the resource investment boom. Now that that competition for inputs has abated, notwithstanding the fact that the residential, we're at the moment constructing as a share of the economy the most number of dwellings that we ever had, that those competitive pressures aren't all that evident in the cost of building houses, and it's because of the resources coming, resources is the wrong word to use here, but the labour and the materials coming out of the resources sector and into the residential construction sector. That said, we are seeing And so wage growth in the construction sector has actually been pretty contained, except for some particular skills such as bricklayers and the like. So that said, at the moment what we're picking up in our liaison is that the competition for inputs between the residential sector, particularly the high-rise residential sector, and infrastructure projects, though, is starting to bite. So we are hearing more reports of increased wage pressure in the construction sector, and it's mostly coming from out of the infrastructure sector now, and it includes competition for labour such as engineers and project managers, as well as competition for materials such as concrete. That said, firms have been able to, in the construction sector, have been limiting cost inflation by switching to lower cost building materials. If I turn to the top panel here, you can see that the pace of rent inflation has been falling since 2008, And at the moment, the annual rate of inflation growth is around of rent is around its lowest level since the mid-1990s. And that's been a considerable drag on aggregate inflation. Rental inflation was nearly 3 percentage points lower per annum in the past 3 years than it was in the previous 20. And again, that all by itself has taken nearly a quarter of a percentage point off annual inflation. So you had phones and rent between each have taken nearly a quarter of a percentage point off total inflation in recent years. So the decline in rent inflation can be attributed to a mix of supply and demand, not surprisingly. As mentioned, housing construction activity has grown strongly in recent years, and we've had a big increase in the supply of rental properties, again, very evident here in Brisbane. Growth in the housing stock has outstripped population growth since 2014, which has put downward pressure on rents. Mind you, that's after a very long period of time where growth in the housing stock fell way short of the growth of population, and hence we had rising rents and rising house prices. The other thing to note about rents is that rents are changed relatively infrequently and are often indexed to the CPI, so there's a somewhat self-reinforcing dynamic to this too. The other thing to note is that just like there is no national house price story, there is no national rent story either. And so you can see here, it really matters where you are in terms of what's been happening to your rent. It's been much lower in Perth than in other capital cities in recent years. Indeed, rents have obviously been falling in Perth at quite a rapid rate for a number of years, and the vacancy rate in Perth has more than doubled since 2008. But as you can see here, slower growth in rents is not just a Perth story. One thing it isn't, though, is actually a Hobart story. But rent inflation in Sydney and Melbourne has slowed considerably in recent years, and again, that reflects a substantial addition to the dwelling stock in both those cities, and that's notwithstanding the faster population growth, particularly in Melbourne. And the other thing you can see here is that rents here in Brisbane have basically been flat for the last couple of years as a decently large amount of construction, particularly in the inner city, has come online. So we expect the pace of rent inflation to increase gradually over the next couple of years, and the vacancy rate has declined over the past year, and newly advertised rent growth has actually increased. So even though I showed you the year-ended rent growth in rents is the lowest it's ever been, what we are seeing is that new rents are actually growing at a reasonable pace now, particularly in some cities. Now I want to talk a bit about services, inflation in services that households buy. So services make up around over one-third of the CPI basket and can be split into two broad categories. So the first of these is what I'm going to call market services. So I've got here the black line is market services inflation, and then the orange line is unit labour cost growth, so wages adjusted for productivity growth. So what are market services? They're services for which pricing tends to be market-based. So they include things like hairdressing, financial services, meals out, and takeaway food. And they're generally driven by domestic factors such as wages, commercial rents, and utility prices, so cost of electricity and the like. There's little or no competition from imports for these services, and they're not affected by movements in the exchange rate. The second category of service price inflation I'll talk about in a sec are administered prices, and they're the services for which prices are at least in part regulated or for which the public sector is a significant provider. They include services such as health, education and childcare, and most obviously utilities, which I'll talk about separately. So for market services, labour costs are around about 40% of the cost base, which means that wages growth is a key determinant of the pace of market services inflation, and you can sort of see from that graph there's a pretty decent relationship between the two. Market services inflation and wages growth were both growing strongly in the run-up to the terms of trade peak that we had in 2011, but more recently you can really see the effect of the slow or the subdued pace of wages growth here contributing to the slower pace of market services inflation. So if you go back to the mid-2000s, services inflation always used to run faster than goods inflation by a couple of percentage points. That's no longer true now. We've now seen services goods inflation hasn't picked up, but service inflation has definitely come down along with wages growth. There have also been a number of idiosyncratic developments that have weighed on market services inflation in recent quarters. But notwithstanding those one-off developments, our outlook for market services inflation is intrinsically related to the outlook for wages. So our forecast is, and it's been true for a long time, that as the labour market continues to tighten, wages growth should gradually pick up. We are seeing that it is gradually picking up. It's come off its bottom, certainly. And along with that, we would expect market services inflation to also increase. However, as we've noted on it any number of times, there's considerable uncertainty about the extent of unutilised capacity in the labour market and how quickly a reduction in that capacity would translate into higher wages and price inflation. It's possible that the unemployment rate could fall a bit faster than we expect and wages growth could pick up more strongly. Or it's also possible that the flow of new workers, and we've seen a lot of this over the last couple of years, into the labour force could continue to be stronger than usual, so that unemployment declines more slowly than we expect and wages pressure could take a bit longer to emerge. Let me now turn to administered prices. So as you can see here, these have generally been running faster than the rate of other prices for the past couple of decades. Most obviously, the one on the top left, cost of health services has been going up more than most other components. Again, in large part, that's in response to the fact that we're now spending a lot more on health than we used to as the population has aged and as we become wealthier. The share of children in formal childcare has also increased markedly, so that's the top right. And the other thing which is going on here is that wages growth, or particularly unit labour cost growth, is generally faster in each of these, those three sectors, health, childcare and education, than it has been in other parts of the economy. So while those rates of inflation generally run faster than most other rates of inflation for the past 25 years, again, like other components of inflation, those rates have tended to slow since 2012. And that's been broad-based across those various components. So education inflation is now noticeably below its inflation targeting average, and in recent years, several state government initiatives have been introduced that have held down the rate of inflation in the education sector. So things like freezing TAFE fees and lowering the cost of preschool education. Annual increases in school and tertiary education fees have been lower than usual, since some fees are indexed to wages growth and CPI inflation. So again, it's somewhat self-referential. If wages and CPI inflation are lower, these inflation rates are lower. You can also see that health inflation has also been lower in recent years, though it's still one of the categories with the highest rates of inflation. So the most recent increase in health insurance premiums was around about 4%, which sounds quite high relative to the rest of the CPI basket. That was actually the lowest average increase in health insurance premiums in more than 15 years. So the pace of childcare inflation has also declined in recent years. On a quarter-to-quarter basis, childcare inflation tends to be affected by changes in the fees that are charged by childcare centres, most obviously. But the other thing which has been going on, those of you who have got kids in childcare, is childcare benefits from the government, and there have been some changes in the level of those payments, and they're factored into the measurement of childcare inflation. The last time the childcare payment system changed noticeably was just on 10 years ago, when the childcare rebate was increased to cover 50% of out-of-pocket expenses. And that, you can see, is a big spike up, actually, before the big spike down. That's the big spike down in childcare inflation in the middle of the graph. So the rebate went from about 30% to 50%. The net effect of that change was measured deflation in childcare prices of over 20% in that quarter. Although depending on where you took your kid for childcare, you may have found that the childcare centre happily adjusted their price to take account of that. But nevertheless, the ABS measured that as a marked decline in childcare. So looking ahead, as we discussed in the recent statement of monetary policy, there are a number of developments in some of these prices which have caused us to lower our inflation forecast for the current quarter, actually, the one we're in now, the September quarter. The education component is expected to be lower because of initiatives in a couple of states to make TAFE education more affordable. As you may have heard, the government's announced changes to the childcare benefit system that came into force on the 1st of July, and that expects us to think that the cost of childcare will fall in the September quarter, not as much as it did back 10 years ago, but still a decent amount. There is, however, a decent amount of uncertainty about the size of that decline, but we have a reasonable amount of confidence that in the current quarter, a number of these prices are actually going to record sizable declines. They may persist a bit beyond the current quarter too. So these identifiable price changes are likely to result in a lower inflation outcome in the September quarter. Obviously, there can be some other offsetting price movements that we haven't, they're not so apparent at the moment, which can go the other way. But we do think, as a result, the next inflation number which comes out is probably going to be a bit on the low side. One thing to bear in mind, though, is that while these prices of particularly these sort of things are going down, it does actually provide a boost to household spending power. So if you have to spend, you know, less on health insurance, less on education, less on childcare, you've got more to spend on other things. And in doing that, that may well boost spending on other goods and services, potentially leading to higher prices elsewhere. Let me just talk a bit about utilities price inflation. So this is, I'll talk about the history because what's going to happen in the future is anyone's guess. It's probably changing as I'm speaking. You can see why it's an issue, and that's because for the last few years they've risen at a faster rate than other prices, in particularly in the last year or so. So the ACCC put out a report into retail energy pricing which outlined the factors contributing to this outcome, and they highlighted significant overinvestment in state-owned networks in some states and the fact that then the networks went and recouped the cost of that overinvestment from their customers. Meanwhile, at the same time, the supply and demand balance within the wholesale market has tightened following the retirement of some coal-fired generation capacity. Another thing which has happened, high prices have also led households to increasingly use solar panels and energy-efficient appliances, which has reduced demand for energy from the national electricity market. So one thing which goes on there is that when you stick a solar panel on your house, you're no longer taking power from the electricity from the network and potentially putting electricity back into the network. The network's still there. You're not paying for it because you're not using it, or at least you're not drawing from it, but the network's still there and someone has to pay for it, which is everyone else who hasn't got a solar panel on their house. So there's a fixed cost of the network. If there's less users, the cost goes up. The gas generation has also become an increasingly important source of energy, but the cost of this gas, and obviously that's a particularly pertinent issue in this part of the world, has increased dramatically alongside the increase in exports and domestic restrictions on further exploration. The ACCC also identified some elements of the energy market structure that have contributed to higher bills for households. Now, high and rising prices are normally a signal to market participants to invest in additional supply because there's been a little bit of policy uncertainty in this area for the last little while. It hasn't been a lot of investment up until recently. What we are seeing now, and so there's been a marked underinvestment in new supply for quite some time, and that's in large part what resulted in those very large price increases over the course of 2016 and 2017. And that clearly boosted, so we saw price rises of 30 to 40% for some households. However, these dynamics have changed quite markedly. Wholesale electricity prices have started to decline from their recent peak. We've seen a large volume of new renewable energy generation, and there's more of that to come online in the period ahead, which may put further downward pressure on wholesale prices. And the recent decline in wholesale prices and an increase in competition amongst energy retailers has seen a decline in market offer prices in many states. And furthermore, many of those energy retailers have indicated they are not going to be changing their standing offer prices in the September quarter, and others have indicated they're actually going to lower their price. So the prices aren't going to go up in the current quarter, discounts are probably going to go up. So our expectation is utility prices are actually going to decline in the coming quarters and actually might be a reasonable drag on inflation in the period ahead. So most of the time, while the utility prices have been boosting inflation for any number of years, now looks like we're heading into a period where they're actually probably going to be reducing inflation. Let me just, for those, this is a, still has a decently large weight in the CPI basket. It's 3%. 3 percentage points, which is reasonably large for a small item. But as you can see here, this for those of you, I'm sure most of you are economists, this is a very good example of inelastic demand. So if you've got something where demand is inelastic, you can stick a tax on it and the price is going to go up and demand doesn't change. And so you can see that's so what we've seen here. But for health reasons as well, there's been large excise increases for a number of years, and that's been boosting inflation. It's been very much boosting cigarette prices. That's going to keep on going for a while yet. So that's, out of all the things I've talked about where the pressures have been on the downside, this is one very obvious thing where the pressures are on the upside, and they're going to continue to be on the upside. They've actually been the single largest contributor to the aggregate inflation rate for quite some time now. So what I wanted to do today was just run through some of these dynamics and discuss how some of those dynamics that we've seen unfold, particularly over the last 3 years, have contributed to the lower inflation outcomes. They've included increased competition in the retail sector, historically low growth in housing rentals, the slow pace of wages growth, and developments in some administered prices. Utilities inflation, as I said, have been boosting inflation for a number of years, but are now expected to reduce it in the period ahead. So our current forecast for inflation is basically the same as our earlier forecasts, but we did revise down our expectation for inflation in the quarter we're in right now, and that's mostly because of these one-off developments. Beyond that, we continue to expect inflation to be around 2.25% over the next couple of years, as above-trend growth in the economy, which we're experiencing now, continues to reduce spare capacity in the labour market. We can see the unemployment rate continuing to come down and generate a further pickup in wages growth. We expect most of those forces that I've talked about today that have contributed to the recent lower rate of inflation to abate, but there is uncertainty about how much longer they will persist, and retail competition is probably the most obvious one of those. We would like to be more confident, so having finally got inflation back to between 2 and 3% in the current in the June quarter, we would like to be more confident that inflation will be sustained at a rate consistent with the target going forward. That said, the Australian economy remains on the path it's been on for at least the past few years. Although inflation is likely to be a bit lower in the near term, we think, just in the September quarter, this is expected to be temporary. Further gradual process in both lowering unemployment and bringing inflation closer to the middle of the target is expected over the next few years. And as a result, the current accommodative stance of monetary policy that we've got in the moment will be maintained to assist in the achievement of that outcome. So let me finish there and hand over to Michael to grab some questions. Thanks.
Well, the Deputy Governor has kindly agreed to answer some questions, but I'm here first, so I get to ask the first two, and then we'll pass it to the floor. After question time, the Deputy Governor and I will leave this platform, and Brian Sheehan, who's the Chairman of Morgans, will come up to propose a vote of thanks. So, Guy, my first question is my Rudy Dornbush question, which I was saving up from before. There's increasing discussion in economics of the foreign exchange puzzle. Actually, there's a couple of puzzles. And currencies no longer seem to be driven by relative interest rates the way they used to be. Currencies now seem to be increasingly driven by momentum. So my Rudy Dornbush question is, why do currencies always overshoot?
Well, the question's slightly different from the premise, but I think the, there does seem to have been less interest differentials seem to have played a lesser role in the recent past than they have historically. I think that's fair to say. I still think they still do play a reasonable role. There's just obviously other things going on. Which have contributed to that, but I still think they do play a reasonable role. We still think there is an exchange rate transmission channel that when we move interest rates, there is an effect on the exchange rate which flows through to the economy and to inflation. I mean, the overshooting story that proposition that Rudy put was basically the exchange rate has to fall far enough, for people to have expectations that it's actually going to rise in the future, and that's when you hit bottom, and that still I think that also still seems to play a role. So you can have this period of overshooting before it reverses. The Australian dollar has actually used to be, particularly back in the day, the poster child for this, where we used to go up the stairs and down the elevator, we'd appreciate gradually and get to a high level, and then we'd fall a long way until we got to a point where everyone was had some confidence that we were going to start appreciating again. I mean, what's interesting in the exchange rate here over the last few years is that the Australian dollar basically just hasn't really moved. On a trade-weighted basis, we've barely budged for almost 3 years now, and even against the US dollar, we've actually traded a pretty narrow range. One thing which I think is interesting to think about, and comes back to something you mentioned, I spent a couple of years of my nightlife developing this code of conduct for the FX market globally, and the structure of that market has changed materially over the last decade and even over the last 5 years. So basically, there are very few people left in the market, in the FX market these days. A lot more machines, a lot less people in the market these days. And this partly comes to your point about momentum. A lot of the trading strategies out there at the moment are very much momentum-driven. Back in the day, there were a decent amount of momentum traders too. But there's a lot larger share of the market these days which trade on momentum and on headline as well. And a lot of that is because they're machine-driven. So machines read the headlines. They've got a trading strategy which is programmed off the back of those headlines. And then they start a movement in the exchange rate, and then a bunch of momentum strategies pile in on top of that until you get a person comes in and says, maybe there's some profit here and I'll take it the other way. But so the market structure has changed a lot in a way which I think is actually having something of an effect on the dynamics in the market.
Okay. So my next question. Now, I'm only allowed to ask one more question. Then we need people to stand up, and there are microphones around the room, and we need people to go to those microphones and ask those questions. So my last question is, last June, a researcher of the RBA, Tom Cuspid, published a paper on the non-inflationary accelerating rate of unemployment. And he estimated that the non-inflation accelerating level of unemployment in Australia is now 5%. Now, for those non-economists in the room, we know there are a few of you, this means that if unemployment is higher than 5%, inflation should fall. If it's lower than 5%, inflation should go up. So my question is, since that time, or since last year, Australian unemployment has been consistently above 5%. And do you think that this relatively high level of unemployment is also a reason that that Australian inflation is so low?
Yeah, yes, it's a short answer. At the beginning of my talk, I said there were a number of macro factors, and that's the largest one of those macro factors that have contributed to the low inflation. We're not miles above it. The unemployment rate at the moment is 5.4%. Our best guess is of the NARU, to save me saying all of the acronym in length, is still 5%. But where there's a decently large amount of uncertainty around that, and it may well be the case that as we get closer to 5%, it may turn out to be lower. Probably in part depends on how fast we get there. Certainly that's been one of the macro factors that has obviously contributed to the low wage growth that we've seen for quite some time now, and as I said during the course of my talk today, that's very much fed into low rates of price inflation we've seen across any number of goods. But the fact that we actually have the unemployment rate coming down to 5% at the end of our forecast at the moment, and as we get closer to that, we'll see whether those inflation dynamics start to change or not.
Okay, questions from the audience? No questions from the audience. Yes, okay.
Just trying to get the last one in there.
Thank you. Guy, I'm one of the non-economists in the room. And as we know, inflation target has been between 2 and 3% for 100 years now, it seems. But why is it 2 to 3%?
That's a good question. It's only 25 years, not 100 years. Why is it 2 to 3%? Because I think there are a number of explanations for that. One is that if you have an inflation target too low, then you potentially get in too close to deflation, and that can lead to dynamics that you don't want to see. I also think 2 to 3 f- fits. So back in the day, Greenspan used to have this definition of inflation. The appropriate level of inflation is one where no one actually pays attention to the rate of inflation. And I think 2 to 3% fits that bill. No one really thinks about the aggregate all that much about the aggregate. We do, but other people don't think all that much about the aggregate rate of inflation when it's in the sort of 2 to 3% zone. There's not massive science as to why exactly it's that number versus some other number fairly close to it. But it's a number which has worked effectively for the Australian economy over the last 25 years or so. We actually had a conference, the Reserve Bank had a conference earlier this year where we looked at 25 years of the inflation target, and you know, the general opinion, and it wasn't just us saying this, was that the regimes actually worked pretty well. But yeah, why 2 to 3%? I think one way to think about it in... particularly for a non-economist, is basically it's a rate of inflation where you're not really going to notice it. If it was much higher than that, you probably would notice it. If it's much lower than that, then you're potentially straying too close to sort of deflationary territory.
Question from Doug McTaggart. We need a microphone.
A question just here as well.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm Ross, did I? That's fine. Guy, good talk. It's good to see the Reserve Bank focusing on the entrails of inflation, which I think is an appropriate thing to do. Two quick but unrelated questions. One, a recent Brookings study came out which substantiated or verified previous work over the last two decades asserting that the rate of inflation constantly overstates the published measure. Constantly overstates inflation by about 1%, which is effectively a 50% overstatement in the current numbers. And you did comment on some of the sort of adjustments the ABS makes, but do you think our numbers are about the same? And secondly, unrelated but inflation related, would you care to comment on the causes of inflation in Venezuela?
Well, that one's an easy one. I mean, Rudy would have... Michael mentioned earlier about Rudy giving unwanted, gratuitous advice, mostly actually to South American dictatorships. So Venezuela obviously very much fits that bill, and he would have, long ago, would have given them any amount of unsolicited advice. But back on the... So on the Australian inflation rate, So I mentioned during the course of my talk, the ABS is now updating the basket annually. So that substantially reduces that known substitution bias. Sorry for the non-economists, but I'll just use that term. But basically, as prices go up, you shift to stuff which is cheaper. That's a quick version of substitution bias. So economists give them these fancy names, but actually they're often quite straightforward. But the so that's gone away. We don't think that was all that large, but it was, well, but large, and, you know, you had a few of those things and you start getting close to that 1% number you were talking about. By the way, in answer to that was actually something I should have mentioned in answer to the previous question. That's one of the other reasons why we had we came up with 2 to 3% was to allow for the problem that this, in trying to actually measure the actual inflation rate. So if you really wanted to have stable prices, you probably have to have a positive inflation rate just because you can't measure it as accurately as you might like. So there's no slur on the ABS. They actually do a really good job on measuring inflation. It's just hard for them to actually do it. But I do think, I haven't seen our latest research on this, but I would guess that our estimate of the bias is actually a bit lower than one, in part because now the ABS has moved to updating the basket more frequently. The quality adjustments that I talked about during the course of my speech that the ABS does are very similar to those that the BLS in the US does. So, you know, whatever that research showed around that for the US numbers would be pretty much the same as it is here. So on Venezuela, and this is, in the long run, you can always, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Print a stack of money, you generally end up with inflation. There's any number of countries in Latin America which have been good examples of that over the year, and Venezuela is very much the poster child of that at the moment. Just one of the when I was working for Rudy, when I was doing my PhD, I was his general gopher and research assistant. One of the books we worked on was on hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic back in the 20s, and hyperinflation in a number of Latin American economies. And so, given what the Venezuelans did yesterday, where they not just lopped five zeros off to the end of the currency, as you do, so that actually is very much out of Latin American inflation playbook 101. So, you know, back in the day when the Brazilian and the Argentinians were also and the Bolivians were past masters of this, this used to happen about once every 6 months. You just lop five zeros off to the end of the currency. Saves you actually having to print a bunch more notes as well by, you know, by adding five zeros. You just lop them off the end. So.
Back to Ross Elliott, I think.
Thanks, Michael. Guy, a quick one because we're short of time. You made the comment that there's no one single housing market. And likewise, there's no really one single economy in Australia, but there's only one single instrument at the Reserve Bank's disposal, which is the cost of money. When you start to see, the perception is at least, that Sydney and Melbourne economies are becoming increasingly dominant in Australia, how do you balance that when you make those evaluations, that trying to cool activity in Sydney and Melbourne will have a much more dramatic impact in a Mackay or a Gladstone or Townsville?
Yeah, So I'm from Adelaide, so that's just something altogether different, I suppose. But the, but so in the end, you're right. We the Reserve Bank, only have one instrument, which is the cash rate, and that affects the whole economy. Other arms of government, most obviously, the federal government have other, you know, fiscal policy is a way where you can deal with some of those regional differences. But in the end, we only have the one instrument for the economy as a whole. The ABS, going back, you know, we aggregate up the economy in proportion. And I certainly don't think we're driven by any one market disproportionately. You know, for instance, at the moment, the Sydney-Melbourne house prices are falling. So, you know, but other prices in other parts of the country are actually rising. One thing which is interesting to note in terms of the regional differences is that at the moment, at least state by state, they're about as low as they've ever been. So the difference in unemployment rates across the states, I'm not talking about different parts of the states, but across the states, is basically as low as it's ever been. My home state, South Australia, now has the third lowest unemployment rate in the country, which is probably the first time in a few decades that's been true. But the regional differences as of today have actually narrowed quite a bit. But it is something we take into account. So one thing we do is that we, as a plug for Paul and our liaison program here, so we have a business liaison program in each state, and they don't just they don't just hang out here in Brisbane. They get out to some of the places you were talking about, to get a better understanding of what some of those regional differences are, to get a better insight into the way, you know, just looking at the aggregate data isn't going to tell you, and talk to the businesses and the community groups in each of those different parts of the country. So we do try and get a lot more colour than just looking at the aggregate numbers. But in the end, as you say, we only have the one instrument, and to some extent, given our mandate, we've got to set it for the country as a whole, but not disproportionately focusing on any one particular region.
Okay, so our last question has to come from Tim Wonhoff, who's a former president of the state of the Economic Society of Australia Queensland Division.
Thank you very much. You mentioned just a second ago the relationship between printing money and interest rates. The United States has printed quite a bit of money, and maybe I don't think we've seen the effect on their interest rates, even though it's crawling up in the last couple of years. Do you have any comment on why we're not seeing maybe a more dramatic impact from that printing of money?
Yeah, that's a good question, and one which has been asked a lot. So one of the reasons why the Fed expanded their balance sheet as much as they did was because of the if you look at the sharp reduction in the banking sector over that period of time then basically filled in that hole. So now, you know, if you put it in basic economics terms, you want to put then the velocity of money went down a hell of a lot, or has gone down a hell of a lot over the past 10 years ago, and the Fed basically intermediated what the banking sector had disintermediated. And now that the US economy is very much on firm footing, it's going along really well at the moment, they're reversing course on that. So not only is the Fed, something that people may not be fully aware of, not only has the Fed been raising its interest rate for the last few years, it's also started to shrink its balance sheet as well. And that's to unwind what it did over the previous 10. As I said, it was those countries which did expand, their central banks expanded their balance sheet, was very much to offset the effect of the massive financial disintermediation that we saw over those over that 10-year, or since the crisis.
Okay, so that's the end of our questions. We'll now leave the platform, and then Brian Sheehan, the chairman of Morgan's Financial, will come up and give a vote of thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for attending this important lunch today. Morgan's is again proud to be a sponsor of the event on behalf of my colleagues and fellow sponsors from UQ, NAB and the Economic Society of Australia. I'd like to thank the Deputy Governor for his address today. Today the Deputy Governor has given us some rare and interesting insights into the workings behind the all-important CPI number. And his address today served as a strong reminder to what a great job the RBA has done in reining in the volatility of, of inflation rates since the early 90s. And it's really comforting to hear his outlook for the future in terms of where this inflation rate's going. I was reflecting down there listening to the Deputy Governor that in my lifetime I've seen inflation rates ranging from 0 to 17%. And certainly when I bought my first house, the mortgage rates were about 17, 18% on the back of a 10% inflation rate, or just under 10% inflation rate. So as you'd imagine, for most of you who are a fair bit younger than me here, that if you were trying to manage that either as a from a personal budget basis or a business basis, it would be a bit of a challenge. So certainly really comforted that the Reserve Bank has done a great job in setting those targets and certainly being able to keep to them. I think I looked at the numbers, and I think since the year 2000, the range has been from about 0 to 6%. So it's been very well tracked. I think judging by the number of people here, Deputy Governor, obviously these insights that we get are very valued or highly valued by the Queensland business community. So thank you very much for that, and thank all of you for attending. I'd also like to certainly express my thanks to Julian and the ESA for the great work for facilitating today, and also for the great initiative in bringing forward these lunches once a year to Brisbane. And given your commitments, I know the Deputy Governor, it's great to take the sacrifice of your time to come up here today and give us a presentation. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Deputy Governor for his presentation today.